Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to FedSoc Forums. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of United States v. Hamani, recently decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us, we have Professor F. Lee Francis, Associate Professor at Widener Law Commonwealth, and William Bergstrom, Partner at Cooper & Kirk. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federal Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Towards the end of the program, time permitting, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through the Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen. And with that, I'll turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. And hi, Professor Francis, looking forward to chatting with you today. I think it makes sense for us to start this off just by sort of giving a little background on the case, and then I think we'll get into the opinions through a discussion. But for those who don't know, the basic facts of the case are that Ali Hamani was charged with violating 18 U.S.C. 922 G3. And G3 forbids an unlawful user or an addict of any controlled substance from possessing a firearm. Generally, Section 922G is where the federal prohibitions on various types of persons possessing arms is placed. G1 is the big one. That's the felon ban. But G3 is specific to controlled substance users. I think it's an interesting question that hopefully we can talk about, Lee, whether or not the facts of Hamani's individual case mattered, but for what they were, his home was searched. He lived with his parents in Texas, and his home was searched as part of an anti-terrorism investigation the federal government was conducting. During the search, he identified for the government agents where there was marijuana in the home, and he admitted in an interview that he used it about every other day. The agents also found cocaine in his parents' closet, but he admitted to being the owner of that as well, although he said he didn't use it and hadn't used it recently. And he surrendered a firearm. The upshot of this was no charges related to terrorism, no charges related to the cocaine, but one charge related to using marijuana on a habitual basis while possessing a firearm under 922 G3. And then in an interesting set of opinions here, the Supreme Court held that 922 G3 could not be constitutionally applied against Hamani. Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, which commanded 7 votes, but it was unanimous as to the result because Justices Alito and Kagan, who did not join the majority opinion, concurred in the result in a short separate opinion. So I think that's most of the background we need. Lee, I guess the first question I have on this that I think we should talk about is, do you think that how would you categorize this opinion? Is it a straightforward application of Bruin, or do you think it's sort of breaking new ground for us?
You know, it's a good question. At first glance, this kind of seems like, a plain vanilla marijuana case and an application of Bruin. But I think when you look at, you know, the facts, when you look at what the court says, it's a lot deeper than that. I mean, the case is really about the limits on, say, status-based disarmament. And I think while Hamani certainly applies the Bruin standard, there is a limitation here that exists, is that we're saying that dangerousness isn't simply something that can be presumed. A legislator can't say, we as a legislative body have found this particular crime to be one that's dangerous enough to disarm someone. And so the court is saying, no, Bruin matters. But there are limitations on these generalized conclusions that legislatures are making.
Yeah, I think that was a big point I took away as well, which is that the court was not going to accept the government coming into court now and saying our law today is about 922 G3 is about dangerousness. And also all these laws we found in the past are about dangerousness. Because I mean, in Rahimi, the court emphasized dangerousness is an important reason why somebody can be disarmed. Rahimi was disarmed because he was found by a court to be dangerous and could be disarmed that way. But here, I think the court is saying, we're not going to just let every analog that you can sort of squint at and call danger stand for that principle, nor will we let any modern law. I mean, I think a big part of this case was the idea that the Controlled Substances Act schedules substances for any number of reasons, some of which might be dangerousness, but many of which are totally unrelated and related instead to, you know, medical use cases. So I thought that was an important point that I think solidified. I mean, would you say that changed Bruin, or would you say that that underscored sort of part of the how and why analysis that, that Bruin was already doing?
I would say it underscores the how and why. And I think the one of the big things that it does, and I think Alito and Kagan kind of come around to this point as well, is we're still going to require a very specific level of generality. You know, lower courts before, and this is kind of what the government's trying to do with the habitual drunkard laws, is say, well, we're going to start with this broad proposition. We're going to say that broadly understood, these laws protected the same conduct at issue here in Helmani. And the court's saying, you know, and this is one of the things I think that that was an outstanding question that they've settled, which is, what level of generality are we going to give to these historical statutes? And the court says, no, we want it to be close enough. It doesn't need to be a historical twin in the language of Bruin, but it really needs to apply to the individual, apply to the circumstances. It can't just be broad and general.
I think that's another important point. I like Gorsuch said at the beginning or early in its analysis of the law, he said that the law, the historical laws targeted different kinds of people, did so for different purposes and operated in different ways. And so I think that puts a little meat on the bones of the how and the why standard. And B, I agree with you. I think it focuses them down somewhat too, because this level of generality question is something the lower courts have struggled with, and I think in some cases gotten pretty close to right. In other cases, they've looked at things way too generally. And I think that asking those more specific questions, did it target different kinds of people? Did it do so for the same purposes or different purposes? And it, how did it operate? Were important application. I wouldn't say it changed Bruin either. I think it's an important application of Bruin that that serves a clarifying purpose.
I think Rahimi kind of complicated it a little bit in the sense of, you know, yes, we can agree that, you know, if a legislator, you know, identifies something as dangerous, well, perhaps that is, maybe that's dangerous. And so I think, you know, Rahimi allowed legislatures to make categorical decisions, where now the court is saying, well, those assumptions aren't good enough anymore. How you get to those assumptions with modern laws and the historical analogs need to be more specific. And I think lower courts were just kind of looking at, you know, whatever, oh, this is close enough, or this is what we think works. And I think Helmani does a good job of saying, well, this is reading Bruin and Rahimi together, you can come to this conclusion, but we're not just going to agree with whatever assumption you make.
Yeah, I think the question of how dangerousness played into Rahimi versus how it plays in here is interesting, because like you said, they are allowed to make a sort of type of categorical judgment in Rahimi. But I think this case, Helmani makes clear that that depended heavily on the fact that there was process before the deprivation, where a judge actually had to have Rahimi in front of him and decide, this particular guy, I'm applying a category, but here I'm looking at the specific individual and placing him in the category of the dangerous. Whereas here, with no pre-deprivation process, nobody looking at this case until the government decides you should have been disarmed. You were disarmed without knowing it, or, you know, if you knew it because of the law, it was without process. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important limitation on some of the ways that people have overread Rahimi, following Rahimi. So I think that's also useful. Did you have any thoughts on how the court applied the changed social circumstances bit of Bruin in this case? I thought that was interesting as well, because they alluded to marijuana and the whole scheduling system for controlled substances is something that was obviously not known at the founding.
Right. And you know, Alito talks a little bit about this as well, where he says, you know, everyone uses marijuana now, or it's widely used. It's the same as, you know, what alcohol was historically. And so, you know, are we really dealing with something that's so different than our founders' bourbon? Right. And in Justice Gorsuch, you know, he says, well, you know, guns and drugs, you know, are, you know, can be bad if you mix them together. But that really wasn't any different from alcohol and drugs at the founding. You know, and he, you know, rattles off a list of examples during oral argument where, you know, folks started laughing, and he, you know, talks about the tankard of bourbon and all these things. And I guess I wonder, well, boy, if just over a period of time, you know, marijuana is the same as alcohol, well, what about all the other drugs that were, you know, legal back then? Not even, you know, we had, you know, cocaine, and we had opium, and we had all these things. So, you know, gosh, is that something now should we consider those things?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess under the logic of Mani, you look at how they're treated now and apply that to the way that things that were treated, like cocaine is still treated very seriously, and heroin or something like that is treated very seriously. So I would expect that the correct way to apply Hamani here would be to say that, you know, you take the seriousness with which we regard those today. And you then ask how you say, you know, somebody who uses heroin today, to use Alito's phrasing, is not like somebody who was drinking alcohol at the founding necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I did think it was useful and interesting that the court emphasized repeatedly how this is a problem that didn't exist at the founding. This is a different type of thing that we have at the founding. And then it didn't at all loosen the Bruin analysis as a result of that. I think if anything, it stressed the degree to which people in the 21st century living in changed social circumstances still have a right that needs to be respected. And the way it went about that, I think, was, you know, going back to your initial point, was it looked at a pretty specific level of generality to try and compare those things across times.
You know what I wonder, and I thought about this more so after Rahimi, is Bruin a stable framework? And I think the societal changes, and I think what Hamani talks about it is basically saying, we're applying this, we're keeping it. It's real, it's workable, but obviously Justice Jackson doesn't seem to think so. And there have been some other, you know, commentators. I think Nelson Lund has talked about this a bit. And so I wonder now, does Hamani solidify the Bruin standard? And I think you kind of touched on this, that this is the standard we're keeping.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it certainly does. With Rahimi, I think, again, there was some more sort of overt explaining of Bruin going on. This strikes me as the first. This is like we've laid out the standard, and now we're going to apply it for you. And the application is interesting, but there was at no point were they saying, we feel like we need to justify this standard. And with seven justices joining it, even though Sotomayor and Jackson in their dissent or in their concurrence sort of said, we think that this still needs to be re-reviewed. I mean, the vast majority of the court anyway seems to be fine applying this mode of analysis and not commentating on it as a unusual thing to be doing, or whether or not it's the way we should continue thinking about things. It seems to me, I let me know if you disagree, but I think it seems to help solidify Bruin as the permanent standard for this type of case.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
Did you think there were a couple of times where I think there's a couple of questions in these cases that have come up again and again, what time period matters? Mm. How should we deal with 922 G1 that the court has flagged and not decided? They mm-hmm. flagged them again and didn't decide them again. I mean, did you think that this case for other 922 G cases provides much guidance, or do you think it's left the law largely unsettled in that area?
I think they've kicked the can once again. I think in the footnote, Justice Gorsuch says, well, under either time period, whether that's the founding or reconstruction, the argument still fails. And so we don't have, I would say even from that, we don't have a clear understanding of what the relevant time would be. I think applying, you know, the other 922G cases provisions, my instinct would still go to what was relevant during the founding era. And I think what Hamani does, even in that footnote, is to say it's possible that it fails under both. But I don't know that we get a clear... We are looking at 1791, or we're looking at 1868. I don't know that the court gives us that definitively.
Yeah, I think it certainly doesn't. I mean, my view has been the same as yours, that you should look at 1791. And I think even when the court has not definitively answered that, I think they've frequently, nodded in that direction is maybe too subtle of a term. I think they've been mm-hmm. very clear that they're looking at 1791 most of the time, even if they're not going to, as a doctrinal matter, settle it. I mean, so one thing that I flagged in this opinion from Gorsuch, she says that our cases demand this attention to history when he's talking about the mode of analysis, because the Second Amendment was designed to codify a pre-existing individual right and guard against its later erosion by majoritarian legislation or judicial fiat. And that seems to suggest that, again, this is one of those things where the reason we're leaving this question open, but the reasoning seems to say, if you're looking at majoritarian legislation, which is, you know, all of the analogs, you have to be very careful that they're not eroding the right. And if it's possible they were eroding the right in 2026 in 922 G3, it seems equally possible that something 100 years after the founding was probably doing the same kind of thing. I think that type of reasoning at least strongly suggests to courts and to litigants where the Supreme Court thinks this is heading, even if they don't feel that they've needed to say it. Mm-hmm. I guess one reason why they maybe didn't need to say it, and I wonder what you thought about this, I think the court seems to treat now this case as a pretty easy one.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I do. Mm-hmm.
That was not my sense of how the case was viewed, at least going into argument. I think after argument, there were many people who thought that this is, but I don't think the government started thinking it was an easy one for the court. And I wonder, was that a surprise to you when you read the opinion that was the way they framed it, or?
I guess I focus, and this is kind of, I talked about this earlier, but I focus on, well, it's just marijuana. And so for me, I'm thinking, well, they know, it's illegal in what, 25 states or 30 states. And, it's not the same. And this is what was surprising about, one. Now, why not? If you charge the cocaine, then I think we have a different story, perhaps. I actually expected that this would have actually yielded real dissents, not just, Alito and Kagan concurring in the judgment. And based on oral argument, I would have thought that the chief and Alito were in dissent. And so the outcome certainly is not what I thought it would be. But I didn't see this as a particularly difficult case.
Yeah, I think that's... I largely agree. This leads to another area I think we should talk about, which is these secondary opinions to the majority. And maybe Alito's the right place to start. So my view is, I've read the Alito Kagan concurrence a couple times, trying to figure out what it is that led them to write separately. Mm-hmm. Because frankly, at times it reads like a condensed version of the majority opinion. Alito hits many of the same points. People who drank alcohol at the founding could do so and possess arms as long as they weren't, you know, misusing them while drunk. And people today, he was basically saying, you know, marijuana occupies a similar position in society today, and people who use it and don't misuse firearms while on it can continue to possess firearms when they're not intoxicated. And he thinks that essentially resolves the case, and he wouldn't say more. I wonder if the reason for the concurring in the judgment is that he just thought, we don't need to say more than this. We could simply say this is not a close case and be done with it. Did you have a different suggest? Because I'm really curious about what the reason for the division there is.
Yeah. You know, on one hand, I guess I took Alito's opinion as a way, as kind of the limiting principle to the majority's view, which is to say that the government made the mistake of looking at these statutes too broadly, and so they just did not match. And so my thought would be, well, if the government had made a different argument, different historical laws, then I think Alito and Kagan would find a way for those laws to justify dispossession. But as you say, he agrees on the central point of the case, which is the historical analogs need to support what the government is actually saying in their argument. And I think for him and Kagan, the idea is that they just did not have the right statutes, historical laws, to justify what they were actually saying.
Yeah, but I also sort of read him as saying there is, I mean, you know, he didn't go out and do his own historical research, or maybe he did, but it's not part of the opinion. But I don't read him as saying necessarily that he's open to a different theory for disarming occasional marijuana users. I think he views that at least as pretty clearly. I think he says those people are not at all like the type of people who were disarmed at the founding.
That's right.
Which is, I mean, I think that's also what the majority is saying. So I think that's an interesting, why are they separate here? Except that maybe that fact alone is enough for Alito and Kagan, and they don't need to address anything else. Then of course, Justices Jackson and Sotomayor concurred, but you know, obviously had significant problems with the fundamental rationale. Mm-hmm. Do you have any takeaways from their concurrence?
You know, nothing particularly new. I mean, Justice Jackson and Sotomayor have been very adamant against the Bruin standard, you know, as it relates to its workability. And I think they're essentially saying, well, they faithfully applied the test. We just don't agree with the test. And I don't know, and I think as you said earlier, you know, Hamani solidifies what the standard is, how it is to be applied, and they don't agree with that as a foundational matter.
Yeah, well, and I wonder, I mean, this seems like a difficult case to make that argument in, because it seemed like the test came off fairly smoothly. Like we applied Bruin worked, they got to a good result, and it makes good sense, both in our world today and in comparison to the historical world they were working against. So I think it's a little difficult to make that same argument in this case, because, you know, the Bruin test is working at the same time that you're complaining it's unworkable. I also thought, I mean, you know, Justice Jackson argues on the one hand, we should be doing interest balancing, and then she charges the majority with doing interest balancing, which I thought that also didn't really land for me, just because, at a very high degree of abstraction, you know, asking how a law burdens the right to keep and bear arms and for what purposes is what this historical analysis is doing. But the difference between that and sort of tiers of scrutiny analysis here is that the yardstick is totally different, right? The yardstick is historical practice and the text of the Second Amendment. Right. And that seems to undermine a lot of the argument that, that Jackson was making in her concurrence in this case.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, for her and Sotomayor, you know, they want to they want a test where you're not bolstering gun rights. They want to be able to look at what the legislators have done and make conclusions that, well, they don't have a right to these things. And I think this test makes it very difficult for them to do that.
Right. Which is, I think very, very much undermines the argument that what the majority was doing is just some form of interest balancing. It's, mm-hmm. it's clearly, I think, changed the metric on that regard. And then the last concurring opinion was Justice Thomas. And I mean, that was a, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that, because obviously I think Justice Thomas, he concludes that this whole 922G edifice should come tumbling down, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. based on the Dormant Commerce Clause, or based on the Commerce Clause justification here being inadequate. I mean, I believe you've told me you've litigated some of these G3 cases and are litigating these G3 cases. Does the jurisdictional hook, how does that work out in practice in these?
Gosh. Well, it's not something. So, for example, in the appellate cases that I've had, we kind of just conceded, because there's not a lot of, you know, Justice Thomas is writing for himself here, but I think courts, you know, just with the commerce jurisprudence, is Congress can do whatever it wants. And so we find ourselves arguing, you know, just history and tradition. But I think what Thomas is doing here is saying, well, if the majority is going to limit this status-based dispossession, disarmament, but he's saying, he's encouraging people, he's hinting at a deeper challenge to the architecture that started the war on drugs, you know, the commerce power. Can Congress actually do this? Now, my thought is this should give litigants some additional argument here to get the lower courts to actually address this issue. And maybe they say, well, Congress can do whatever it wants. But I think Justice Thomas is saying, hey, this is a question we need. It wasn't an issue in this case. But maybe this should start percolating below so that maybe we will get to decide it eventually.
Yeah, and I know it was raised in some amicus briefs in this case, which I think teed it up, because there has been, I mean, there's been some sort of vocal lower court judges also flagging this issue that, you know, this does not seem consistent with the Supreme Court's other cases on this issue. Obviously, in one sense, you know, just handling the Second Amendment issue here is a narrower ground, and so the court, you know, happily resolved it that way. But I've had the same experience in appellate cases dealing with 922G cases, where there's this, did the firearm transfer like pass in interstate commerce? Mm-hmm. Almost certainly, mm-hmm. most of them do. But it's a very odd thing to have tacked onto these, and I think he's right to flag it anyway as a key issue going forward. Was there anything else about the opinion? We're just about out of time. Was there anything else about the opinion you thought was worth stressing here?
Well, I think the big thing is just to note, you know, what all of the things the majority says the opinion does not cover. You know, we don't know about the addicts. We don't know about active intoxication or its impact on mental health or felon in possession. Are there things that the litigants can do to make arguments related to Hamani? Absolutely. But the court leaves those doors open.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. At the same time, I think that the work it's done here of making clear it's going to require, a focused historical analysis at a fairly low level of generality that, you know, respects the right to keep and bear arms. I think that does if it doesn't answer all those questions in G3 cases going forward, I think it does provide some meaningful guardrails for the court in those, or the lower courts in those discussions going forward. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to, more litigation to come, I'm sure, but it'll be interesting to see. Well, Well, I think, is Alex on?
Yes, thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panel for sharing their time and expertise with us, and I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.